Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Our next guest is a singer, songwriter, and award-winning actress. She won a Golden Globe for her performance in The United States versus Billie Holiday. And she's also my sorority sister. Shout out to Andra Day. What's up, girl? How are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm great. How are y'all?
We got to tell you, the first time I ever heard your voice, it was Christmas time. And I think it was an Apple commercial. Remember that? So I was, because usually when old white people are doing stuff, I'm like, all right, I don't care about this.
Right.
I hear this song, and I actually thought it was Billie Holiday. I thought it was her. I thought, and then I go, who is the girl on the Apple commercial? I remember talking about it to everybody. Matter of fact, I downloaded the thing so I could hear the song over and over again. And then years later, I went out and bought your first album. Then I heard the Stevie Wonder thing. And then I saw you on the movie, the Billie Holiday movie. And it made perfect sense. Sense. Do you think you were born to play that role?
I mean, now when people reflect and we talk about all these different pieces, and I've loved her since I was 11 years old, you know. It seems a little ordained, you know, but it's funny listening to that now, because when we first were embarking on this journey, I was like, hell no, I'm not interested.
Right.
But I'm grateful. I'm really grateful that I didn't self-sabotage my way out of it, because I think...
I saw it right after I took the vaccine, and then she had seen it, and I had seen clips. I watched the whole movie, and the two things I thought immediately was, you literally embodied her, literally. And the other thing is, like, what a hard life. Like that was a terrible, such a multi-talented, empathic human being that had this terrible role to hold. Were you connected to it? Like, did you feel a lot of pain going through that, playing that role?
I mean, you know, and just like in the spiritual sense, in the emotional sense, psychologically, you know, and physically even, you know, I feel like there was just, and fortunately Lee, he was just an incredible director, and he connected me to Tasha Smith, who was my acting coach.
Yeah,
really
Tasha. Yeah.
Pull up personal pain and to really hold on and live in it. But I also, in order to just touch, you know, what Billie Holiday would have experienced at the time, I had to put my body through it as well, too. I had to really damage my vocal cords with, you know, doing things I don't typically do. I don't drink, I don't smoke, you know, I don't.
Me neither.
Drink.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't do that at all. who would do something as dumb as that?
That's just some smooth Coca-Cola, you know what I mean?
Yeah, me too. It just has something in it. When I was watching you, because to me, the hardest thing to do in acting is to cry and to make love. Like, those things are very hard. And you were convincing in each, like, all those things, I thought, wow, she's really connected to an emotional place and to be in a lot of love scenes. Because usually it takes a while to be that comfortable. It takes a while to emote that much. What was the more difficult? Was it more difficult for the emotional roles, or just kind of being naked and open and having everybody around? That had to be difficult too.
Yeah.
Not for me to see, but it was for you to do. I'm sure I watched. But
then the job was done.
right. I had to stop several times, but let's not go on about that. That's not what we're talking about. What was tougher for you to do artistically?
I think artistically, I think, you know, what's interesting. I think it was, I want to say both, but they were so different. You know, the emotional thing for me, I'm very much like we are as most humans. It's you compartmentalize, or as I say, lay things down so that I you're not so, so sort of inhibited by your emotions and by these traumas and these experiences. So, you know, having to pull that up was difficult. Having to sit in it and live in it and stew in it was extremely painful, you know, and facing certain family realities, that was painful. And then, yeah, it was uncomfortable for me doing these love scenes, but I think the thing that landed, especially the main love scene that we had with Trevante, I think the thing, my discomfort in doing the scene actually lended itself to Billy's discomfort being loved by a person. I think it's extremely difficult to be vulnerable and to be loved by a man. And was confused, I think, by the gesture, because she was so used to men abusing her and taking advantage of her. And so, you know, and in the scenes where they wasn't loving like that, I'm a woman, you know what I mean? So we've experienced certain things from men. I know what it's like to sort of turn your brain and your emotions off and just say, all right, I'm here and I'm just going to get this done. You know what I mean? So they were just different. It was all different, you know what I mean? And all very trying.
It's interesting because everybody who embodies a role like that, some part of them is that person. Small part of them, that person lives in a small part. Like when I watched Jamie become Ray, which is like, because those are people that I like knew, and those are people, like he was a guy that really became Ray. And I think much like you became Billy, what part of you is her? Which part? Was it the artistic part? Was it the pain part? Was it the kind of, empathic part? What part was it?
First of all, I think the empathic part, definitely, which I will say, and the loving music, you know what I mean? Just really, just sort of being, kind of becoming a part of the music as you're performing. But I think the empathic part too, I do love people. And I think Billie Holiday's magnetism is due to the fact that she didn't judge people. She just loved people. She received them. She accepted them. She celebrated them for who they were, all of their facets, all of their layers. They were able to just be there and to be who they were and to be present with her. But I think all of that really falls under a greater blanket of I am a Black woman living in America. You know what I mean? And that comes with its own inherent set of traumas. Oftentimes this sense of invisibility, which is why we fight and why we push so hard to not just to be seen and to be validated and to feel valuable, but also for other people's causes. You know, we shoulder a lot of people's burdens, and that comes from the empathy side of things. And that's how, so, you know, I don't know what it's like to be a Black woman in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, to be a Black queer woman singing about lynching in America. But I know what it's like to be a Black woman. I know certain expectations that are placed on you, and people's sort of unfair judgments of every single thing that you do. You're too hot, you're too cold, you're too loud, you're too quiet, you're, you know, too brazen, you're too prudish. You know, it's that sort of uncomfortable batting back and forth. I'm familiar with that, you know.
I don't know that there's a distinguishable, the difference is distinguishable. I think that, you know, the apparatus has changed, the technology changed, but I think the sentiment toward Black women has always been the same.
Yes,
I think that no matter, you could look at what happened to Sister Soldier and trying to use, so it doesn't matter. What does it say about us as a country and our, this country's perspective of Black women that so little has changed? Little has changed between, you know, there are things that they might not do as overtly, but I still think the character assassination, the assault of your personhood, all of that still is the same, right?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, first of all, I'd agree with that. And I think what it says is that systems that were put in place when Billie Holiday was alive singing about Strange Fruit, systems that were put in place post, you know, the abolition of slavery, right, during Reconstruction, Jim Crow, segregation, just racial terror, you know, systems that were put in place to continue monetizing and criminalizing Black bodies. I think there's some things Billie Holiday might, if she were here today, would say, wow, that's definitely a lot different. And there's some things that she would look at and say, wow, what they did back then is working now.
What would she say? Because there is a certain amount of activism that people just inherently, I think, in order for people to gravitate you as an artist, you have to be quintessentially human. And I think nothing's humor more human than seeing somebody else's plight and trying to illustrate it. That's in my estimation. And even your voice, when I first heard it, I was asleep. I was kind of going to sleep. And it was that kind of thing. And I think those are the only thing. The only way people learn from us is if we're singing, dancing, running, or jumping. That's the only way. And they get it accidentally. Like, hey, nigga, why you ran that touchdown? You did say something about people. Like, they can't. Like, it can't be on the nose. It really can't be. We're never gonna. They're never gonna listen to us. We have to be singing, dancing, running, or jumping. We have to. In other words, it can't be on the nose. And I think that you ever think that your talent was your way to be a lens for people to see humanity, or to see something they did not have such a jaundiced view of people of us?
You know, well, first of all, yes, I do believe that, because I look at these things as gifts. You know what I mean? You have yours, obviously, that have blessed us, and I have mine, and everyone has their different gifts, which don't always manifest themselves, you know, sort of like in the arts. So I absolutely think that it is a tool, but I also do think, you know, I am of the ilk that, you know, yes, you can receive it through singing. Yes, you can receive it through dancing. Yes, you can receive it through the arts, but we're getting to a point now, and we've been there, but I think we're, you know, especially with the advent of the internet and social media, now everything is, the globe is much smaller, and people have access to so much information. And to other people around the world struggles. And so we saw this global effort of supporting Black Lives Matter, in support of Black Lives Matter. But I think that we're getting to a point now when, you know, you just need to receive it. You know what I mean? It's not, as, you know, as James Baldwin always put, how much time do you need for your progress? You know, dance for me, sing for me, make me comfortable, because that's where I'm comfortable seeing you. Well, you have to be uncomfortable then. You know what I mean? You need to get comfortable being uncomfortable and seeing us in places and in positions and represented in areas that we have not been traditionally, or that we've been kept out of. And so, yeah, I think they need to receive it through the arts, but also sometimes it's just a direct message to just, you know, if you're not with it, you know what I'm saying, then you got to go.
No, you don't. You better not be direct. What makes you laugh?
What makes
When's
me
the last
laugh?
Time you really like just cracked the fuck up? What makes you laugh?
I laugh all the time. But when was the last time? Oh, you know what? Actually, the last time I laughed was just the other day, because I played a prank on my day-to-day manager. Because my day-to-day manager is like the oldest young nigga I've ever met in my life. He's like a 30-year-old pop, you know what I mean? So I played a joke on him. We were at a hotel, and I slipped a note under his door, because I know my fans and, like, their voices and how, you know, and they because of Rise Up, they, you know, they share a lot with me.
Right.
So I had slipped a note under the door. What did I name this dude? What was his name? Lindell. I came up with me and my cousins. We were just bored, and so we wanted to play a joke on him. This was just, what, last night or two nights? So we wrote a note, and we came up with the name Lindell Robertson, and he was from Jersey. And he just moved to L.A. from Jersey, and he was struggling to get work because of COVID, you know, but he finally got a job at this hotel, you know, and he's been a big fan of mine for a long time, and he found out that I'm staying at this hotel, and here he is now, and he slipped a note under Josh's door and is asking for access to my room. So it's funny. My day-to-day is sitting there trying to figure out, he's like, shit, if I give this man, she's going to probably want to meet him and probably want to pray with him and probably stress me out. So, but then when we finally let him in on the joke, his reaction was amazing. So we laughed pretty hard about that.
You know what's funny? That was a real note that I sent in, because your joke, it got fucked up. So thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. It's
that's
all
hilarious.
Everything's funny except me not getting to meet you in the lobby of your hotel.
So what are you going to do next? I know you were probably apprehensive. You talked about that, about playing Billy, which was amazing. So many surprising things that I learned, right? But what do you want to do next? What do you want to act in next?
You know, so it's funny. I'm really just starting to get back into the idea of wanting to do this. I like auditioned for like some things here and there, but I didn't feel fully kind of like ready in my spirit. But now I'm on the other side. I thought I was going to retire, but now on the other side, I'm like, okay, you know, there's so many stories of ours that need to be told. So I want to be a part of, you know, if it's another name or another hat in the ring that can help push these narratives forward and tell the truth about them, you know, I want to do that. So, but what I'm really excited about Possibly something else with Lee Daniels again, because I just love.
Well, we know it won't be a comedy. That's for goddamn sure. It won't be. It won't be.
Maybe I need to do a comedy so I can get my head.
Yeah, wait, man. It won't be Precious on Ice. We know that. that is one of the things about when Lee Daniels was here. Automatically, I went, this is going to be award worthy, because I don't think he knows how to make just the fan. Like, he just, all his film have a certain bend to them where they're very melancholy, they're beautiful, and they feature somebody you never saw coming. All of that. But I'm always amazed that he seems to have a talent for making a film that no one could ever imagine, and talent that nobody could have imagined embodying that film. So you did. Are you going to go back on the road as soon as this thing clears up?
Yeah, so we do. We have an album that's releasing June 4th, I'm excited about. So the new singles are, well, Tigress and Tweed was the first single off the album, and the new singles are coming in April. But I'm writing, too. I started, there's so many stories, I think, of ours that have not been told intentionally so. There's a project that I'm developing right now. It'll be like a limited series. So I just started, you know, researching and writing, and just want to co-write and co-direct and co-produce and just work with just great people that I've met, you know. In
the story you're writing now isn't about you writing a note and scaring the shit out of your role, man. It's not that, is it? Hey, wasn't it funny how she...
I think that's good, though, because I think there are a lot, like you said, a lot of people that we don't know their stories. Like, I really thought the story of Billie Holiday was she was an amazing vocalist, and it was Lady Sings the Blues. And so seeing this, it was not that. And learning about, you know, her... passion about this particular song and her refusal to not actually say I'm going to sing this song. You know, I think that's important. And I can just imagine how many other stories we're not getting.
Yeah, she really was the godmother of the civil rights movement as we know it today. Right. She was. It was her singing Strange Fruit in defiance of the government and the death of Emmett Till, but her side was scrubbed clean. That reinvigorated Thurgood Marshall in the movement. And so she really put the battery in the back of a lot of great civil rights leaders that we know of today, and we were never supposed to know that about her. There's, you know, even the internet went crazy when they discovered Beethoven was African, right? Yeah. You know, where I always bring up Hidden Figures and how it changed me to know that three black women were responsible for getting us to space and programming the first computer, or that the brave act of a slave infiltrating the enemy camp really netted America its independence, you know. And so these are stories we're never supposed to know, the full scope of our struggle, of our contribution, of our triumph. And I think if we're going to dismantle a system that has been built on lies and deception, then we have to inject it with a lot of truth, you know. And so that's why I want to continue in films, maybe on the other side of the camera, but because there's just so much. We have so many stories that need to be told, you know.
You know, it's so funny. Your voice, your speaking voice sounds like that same timbre as your singing voice. You ever notice that? Okay. You ever think that?
Annoying?
No, it's not annoying. It's not annoying. It is now that you fucked up my letter to you. That's annoying. But this part is when you have been,
girl,
you,
just
you,
ignore him.
You grew up in Seattle, right? You grew up in Seattle, or was it close to Seattle?
I was born in Seattle, but I actually grew up in Southeast San Diego because my father was
good.
In the military.
Okay.
So it was like right after I was born, we traveled down the coast, and then he was stationed in San Diego.
When people heard you, because it's not, San Diego's not an urban town. Well, I guess it is a lot of niggas in San Diego, I'll tell you that. It's a ton of niggas in San Diego. I shouldn't say that. It is actually a lot.
It is. Where I grew up, it is, but it's not. We do get hella overshadowed by the city, and that's like a big part of what I shed light on too, so I'm glad.
Because when I came from LA to San Diego, niggas is everywhere. They're scared. Everywhere. When you first start singing, that is a very unusual voice, right? Like it's very unusual. What is the worst thing anybody ever said about your voice and the things that they thought you were capable of or not capable of?
What was the worst thing? Oh my God. I mean, what was the worst thing somebody said about my voice?
Are you high? What the hell is going on?
You know, or it's just, it's screechy, or it's not, you know, it's not a real singer, or, you know, all these things. To be honest, the first insult I ever saw, and it was the moment I decided I'm never going to look at the comments again, but it was somebody wrote, I had just uploaded something on YouTube, and I went to the comments to see, I wonder if people are responding well. And the first comment, and I probably shouldn't say this on the show, but bleep me, the first comment, because you know they love to call us this, was nigga bitch. And yeah. I was like, yeah. Literally, my response was, but did you?
Oh, don't worry. They call us that too, so it's the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, people will say things, you know, and all that stuff. But fortunately, I got to tell you, and it's another full circle moment. It was Billie Holiday. It was discovering her at 11 years old that eventually helped me to own my own voice, because I just remember hearing her for the first time, being like, I was like 11. And I was just confused. I was like, this don't sound nothing like Whitney. And I'm thinking, I have to sound like Whitney, and I got to sound like the pop singers of my time. And you know, it doesn't sound like Aretha. It doesn't sound like Patti. Doesn't sound, but this is one of the greatest vocalists of all time. Okay, so how, you know, so she changed my idea of what a great vocalist was and my own personal contribution. Ultimately, it was her ownership of her own voice that helped me to accept my own. Like, you know, it is what it is. It's just going to be what it's going to be. And I either got to love it or move on and not use it. But so it was her who really helped me to say, okay, it's different in my tone. Sometimes I like it, sometimes most of the time I hate it, but it really actually helped me to accept my voice and say, this is my contribution. And so
are you excited to get back on stage again, because now it looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel, and you come from, now people are used to, you've had a lot of exposure with this. War season's come up, and there'll be a little more. I'm sure that you're going to do very well there. And people will have, there are going to be people who only have seen you in this light. They're going to be, and they're going to come with a certain expectation that has its own trials and travails. Are you excited about disconnecting from all of that and being what you are, which is ultimately an entertainer?
You know what I'm most excited about? I'm excited about not disconnecting, but allowing it to mold me and be a part of my story and who I'm supposed to be in this new season of my life. You know what I mean? Because it's, you know, I've been her for 3 years now. Three years of my life has just been Billie Holiday. So I really, to be honest with you, I didn't know who I was when I left set. You know, I hadn't been her for so long, and it was so deep in her headspace, and I don't think I even realized how deep it was. So, you know, this idea of going back to Andrew was so foreign to me. And I realized, you know, I wouldn't be the same 3 years from now as I was 3 years ago anyway. None of us are.
Right.
She pushed me faster and further, you know, or I say God used her to push me faster and further. But, and so I'm excited to just take it all into this new season and into this new space, and just to appreciate who it is I am in this season, and to explore that, and to explore that with my audience and with, you know, these people that support me and who I love. So,
I loved your voice from the first time. And I'm scared to meet people because I'm going, oh, I can't stand this motherfucker. I can't, I don't know how this happened. Give me my goddamn note back. I don't even know. I hate that I wrote it. Well, I'm glad you're what I thought you were. I'm excited to see what you do. I'll say this: if there's a kind of thing in you that shines through, whether you're this or whether you're, no matter however in any incarnation I've ever kind of experienced you, there's always been a thing you have, and I hope you always keep it. I really do. I think it's dope. I'm looking forward to your next project. And when is that out?
That's June 4th.
And what's it called?
I don't know yet.
Such a beautiful slow woman. Jesus
Christ.
Don't
do that.
She's
don't
so
do that.
Beautiful. I love when women laugh like that. You know, like they the only ones in the room. Often either they're having a nervous breakdown or they're really having a good time. Hey, I'm thank you for joining us on the program, and you keep doing what you do.
Thanks, Andrew.
Me and you is gonna always be enough. Thank you, Andrew.
Oh, for sure.
Thank you.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to DL Uncut. Our first guest is the manager and founding partner of Backstage Capital. Her book, It's About Damn Time, is available wherever books are sold. Please welcome Arlen Hamilton. I like your sweatshirt.
Right. Right.
Thank you.
Super dope.
It's from the Versus.
Yeah. Ooh. What a Versus it
you,
was.
You look like you come to get some money. You better give me some goddamn money.
And
shut
right
up with that
now.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
So you are, it's a venture capitalist, right?
That's right.
So you basically get funds from rich people.
That's essentially, yes. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. It took a while, but yes.
But you started out homeless.
I did. I had a lot of housing insecurity and food insecurity for most of my adult life, yes.
Why do they call it insecurity? You ain't got a house and
you're
hungry.
That's a nice way to say it.
That's a better way to say it.
Yeah, there's different versions of it. I mean, you know, some people think homeless, they think, okay, you got to be out in the street. Right. You got to be laying on concrete. And I just had different versions of it. I didn't have an address for a long time, you know. And,
it's so just challenged.
Yeah, my brother-in-law has that, but he ran in front of the police. So I don't know if it's just regular insecurity.
You have to excuse me, DL, because you're a legend, and I'm tripping out right now.
Thank you. It's interesting that you would start off homeless, and then because it venture capitalism is mysterious to a lot of people. Like nobody knows. All I know is whenever you want something, they talk to a bunch of dudes who decide whether you're worth it or not, and you get money for poor black gay people, right?
Yes, they're all not poor, but yes, black people, Latinx, women, LGBTQ, everybody, 90% of venture funding goes to white men in the United States.
Right.
They make up a third of the country.
Right.
So we all know that that's not right.
So how did you, because no one, that's got to be like no one, like in order, like,
yeah, but how do you even get into
like,
that?
Like, hey, look, I want to get money for black people.
Yeah. I just looked at it as if I didn't have money on the table, I would not be allowed in the room. I could scream about it. I could write about it. I could yell about it. But I had to be about it in order to be in the room to make change. And so I said, yes, I am poor. I'm broke. For 35 of my 40 years, I was under the poverty line, didn't make $20,000 in income until I was 36 years old. And now that's different. But I said, those are my personal circumstances. That doesn't change the fact that this is ridiculous, that there's no money flowing or not enough money flowing to people I know should have that capital.
What is the impediment? Because people have to believe, one, that you're worthy, that they can, because it's about being able to generate income, right, for the investment to be worth it. So that we'd have to see them. If we can't get people to build supermarkets in our neighborhoods or viable businesses in our neighborhood, then you went to the people that those investment come from. How were you able to convince them?
That's right. So some of it is racism. Some of it is bigotry. Some of it is just inherent laziness from people who are very wealthy and have a very kind of specific way of life, and they don't want that to be disturbed or you know, messed with. And I just said, you know, instead of I'm going to do the bang head bounce on the boat and forget rocking. Like, I just came in all, like, loud and saying what nobody else was really saying out loud. We were saying it, kind of whispering it, hey, there are no women in this room. There are no black people in this room. Why are they not on boards? Why are here and there? And venture, it was whispered about.
Right.
And I said, look, you know, if you went to one of the three schools that most venture capitalists went to, MIT, Stanford, et cetera, and those are the only people you've ever met. And of course, you know, there are black people and women at those colleges, but you spent your time with certain people. That's who you're going to continue to invest in. Venture capitalists have said out loud with microphones in front of them, I look for someone who looks like Mark Zuckerberg.
Who?
Because that's pattern matching for me.
It, you know what's funny? Who was it? He was the chairman of a bank. I think it was Wells Fargo. And he said, I don't see any, I just don't see any black talent. I just don't look around. What was his name?
I don't know. But
he said he didn't see any black talent. And rather than take him at his word and say, well, what can we do so that you do come into your perspective? We got mad and made him apologize when he was only telling you the truth. I think that the problem is that we are not in the places that they need to see us. We're visible. We are not in their perspective. And the way to get that is not to make them apologize, but to make us, to put us in a position where we can be viable products for them or applicants for them.
That's right. And I think the more they see people making money and exits happening, the more they get it. It's just like movies and everything else. You know, everybody's so surprised that Black Panther did well. Of course.
right.
But it's like that's what you're starting to see in venture now. You're starting to see these tech companies blow up, these companies led by Black people and women. Bumble just had their IPO. So now everybody in Silicon Valley is like, find me the next Bumble. Find me the next Whitney.
Right.
Who runs it. And what I'm saying is, what I was saying 5 years ago and 10 years ago to people was, that's going to happen. We're going to have our heyday. Let's get into it early, and we will work with the companies very early so they can become that.
Right.
Yeah. And so, how did you get them to listen to you, though? Because I know the one big obstacle that Black women have specifically is, you know, if you are opinionated, if you are progressive in the way that you think and aggressive and loud, you're labeled as the angry Black woman, or no one wants to listen to you and work with you. How do you flip that?
It's true. I have been. I'm very outspoken. My thing was, I did not care if the titans of industry did not like me. That didn't matter to me. And I also feel like I have a privilege in knowing that I can go and blow stuff up, knowing I don't have children, and knowing that I can kind of step into
right,
it. Like
right,
that.
Right.
And I took on a lot of that, the brunt of it, because I said it needs to be said. I don't care if the person sitting across from me is a billionaire. That it means nothing to me. It really doesn't. And so once you start fighting back and saying what's really out there, then more and more people come out and say, yeah, that I feel that way too. And it becomes too loud for somebody to ignore.
Right.
And then also on top of that, we were executing. So we were raising capital. We were making investments in companies by underrepresented, underestimated founders. We're at 175 companies. When people were laughing at me in 2014, when I said, I'm going to invest in 100 companies by underrepresented founders by 2020, they laughed me out of rooms and told me to come back when I was saying something that was logical. We reached that May 2018 because there's so much talent out there.
I say all the time that we miss the industrial age. We missed the manufacturing age. If we miss the technology age, we're going to be having this income disparity conversation all the time. And I think I've always wondered, the government and tech, like I always see tech companies being fined by the government, or, you know, having, you know, these stipulations put on them by the government. And it would be more advantageous for tech companies to work with Black colleges, historically Black colleges, or Black state schools, to kind of spread the wealth, and they can be, in essence, become the farm teams for those kinds of tech. Because the only way you make money is the NASDAQ. Like, large amounts of money really fast now is the NASDAQ, and we're just shut out of that. Like, for tech, we sell, if they want to sell a fancy gadget, they use us, and the best we get out of that is working at the Apple store. So I think
it's true, and you can see it now. Twitter, there's a reason we talk about Black Twitter. Same thing is happening with Clubhouse. We build these companies either by being consumers of it or building it behind the scenes. It is definitely like life without, you know, a day without a Black person, a day without a Latinx person.
Right.
It's definitely that in tech. And what it really comes down to, I can make investments and I can scream about it. And I think that's moving the needle, and it's having the conversation. What it's going to come down to are these founders who are not sitting around waiting for the 100 or so, mostly white men, who get to tell them yes or no. They're building on their own.
How is that possible, though? Because I think that it's like you don't even know. How do you even know to approach them? How do you get into the room? Because you went in selling a product that no one had ever thought. It certainly didn't have much vibe. But listen, I want you to work with these Black people, these gay people, these Latin people who ain't got a goddamn thing except a great idea.
And on top of that, I'm broke, and I'm gonna put that money in my bank. But I'll tell you what, that's almost accurate. But there's part to it that I did have. Those people had more than an idea. They were building companies already. They didn't sit around and wait. And so the proof became in the, you know, was in the pudding. Because I'm like, this is not just an idea. Make a Wish Foundation, everybody's happy. This is viable companies that are making money. and you're missing out because you have a blind spot. And you can choose to be willfully ignorant or not.
You're literally the new Booker T. White. You're literally the new, you're literally, because that kind of thinking, I would imagine, I don't want to speak for you, you believe that economic freedom, educational freedom, affords you certain amounts of protections in a society, right?
Protections and success. And, right. You know, I say that my success, my unbridled success is my activism.
Right. So you could tell that's your perspective. What do you think is the biggest impediment? Because it isn't just the business. It's also people that aren't aware of it and people that think that these things are impossibilities. I think that one thing about black, we tend to be the audiodidactic. We learn by hearing and seeing. Mm. And so no one would ever have known that unless they see you. We play basketball because you can learn it free and you see people. We learn that we can get gold medals and shit you learn how to do free at the park. And yeah. This isn't that. This isn't that. It's yes. But this is really the big chip in the game. This is how fortunes change. This is how communities move forward. And we don't yes. seem to understand its nuances and mechanisms.
That's another reason why I'm investing the way I am. It's not just for the returns to come back to me, but for the narrative to change. Because through these companies going on to do well, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's happening. That there will be new tech titans. The visual of a tech titan will be different. So they'll start to see, the different generations will start to see different people. On top of that, art is going to imitate life. And so you're going to have more television shows, more movies, and more scripted podcasts that are going to have as a protagonist the tech, the black tech woman CEO.
Right.
Because yeah. it's happening in real life. And all of that. And somebody asked me, you know, what's it going to take? I said, it's going to take Beyonce going on TV and saying that she's invested in these 10 companies led by underrepresented founders. And she's already started to do that. And I was using her as an example, but it goes across the board when it comes to media.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times, especially the younger generation coming up, they don't see that.
No. Nope.
It's not in their nope. area. Even we saw it specifically during the quarantine when you had a lot of urban families who didn't even have computers. They didn't have yep. access to any, you know, type of thing.
Enough
that they
devices.
Need for,
yeah.
Absolutely. So I think it's important yes. that we see that kind of thing not only on TV, but also in our communities.
That's right. And so many of the founders that we invest in, on top of just making great companies, they also want that impact. So we have an investment where they're trying to have broadband available in all, in every Wi-Fi in every neighborhood in the United States.
But why wouldn't that? Okay, the interesting thing about that should be a part of a new educational apparatus, right? That should be mm-hmm. how we, like instead of building new schools, we need to build new avenues to education.
Yes.
And there are people, when we talk about an infrastructure, that's just not bridges and airports and railroads. That is, you mm-hmm. know, a technical infrastructure,
right.
too. And I think that there are ways that we could just be enriched being a part of that. Like if we got to bring broadband to all these communities, it should be communities of color that have a hand in being involved in that, right?
And that's what's starting to happen. And that's what the future looks like. There's another company that we've invested in. They're putting down new sidewalks that are smart sidewalks. So they're going to have a tap into everything in the city to help with the infrastructure, you know, every piece of it you can think of, because you're going to be able to dial into a dashboard with smart cities. And
wow.
it's the perspective, the black perspective, the female perspective, et cetera, that is missing, has been missing, but it's now is showing up and represented. And that is what is like this wave that is, you won't be able to stop it.
You know what's interesting? I often have conversations with people, but most of those conversations center on the past. They're reparative. They're, you know, restorative kind of ideas. This is like, I haven't seen a black woman talking with the fugitive as much as Miss Cleo. Goddamn. it's the first time I've ever realized, and I always say this, but our best pathway forward out of this thing is forward. And that has to be with technology and all the other things we can avail ourselves to. That's amazing.
That's it. I mean, you basically just helped me with my shareholder meeting, because that's all I have to do to explain it. Just explain everything that's going on in here. It's about the future.
All right. What number should I place? Is you all?
Yeah.
Help me with the goddamn lotto numbers. Oh. It has been a pleasure. A pleasure.
Look, keep up the good work.
Really, really.
I appreciate it.
This smart sidewalk, can it take me anywhere I want to go without nobody knowing?
Nope. It will eventually.
Okay. Will. I'm going to hold out for it.
Erase your history on it.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.